Hello, friends. Welcome to episode 250 of Against Everyone with Connor Beebe with my guest, Caitlin Doty. Caitlin was part of the show from the beginning, which is almost 7 years ago now. Way back when I started, she let me borrow her equipment, and we even shared an editor, Caitlin's friend, my friend, Landis Blair, who worked with both of us to make our episodes even more interesting and much better and poppier. The episodes of my show, obviously, Against Everyone with Connor Beebe, and her massive YouTube hit show, Ask a Mortician. So I'm still doing this work 7 years later, and plenty has evolved and changed. And in the meantime, Caitlin's been doing it too. She's been writing best-selling books, running a YouTube channel, running a nonprofit and a funeral home, and doing appearances. Last year, she finally decided to take a break. So this is her first real appearance in someone else's media in 7 months. One thing that Caitlin and I have been talking about that whole time, since she didn't take a sabbatical from our friendship, thankfully, is the decline of the effectiveness of all forms of content-based media to shift narratives or generate a sense of meaning in people's lives, and how that affects our work and what we do and how we view our role in the world. How do we address and change that? I mean, this might sound silly to you because, you know, there is a total ubiquity of online platform media, of content-based media, but it does really seem to be unable to mediate or inspire narratives in the same way. And I also think people are just getting a bit worn out from it, the audience and the creators. It's something I'm hearing from lots of my friends who have been in this as long as me or longer, and from some people who are new to it too. TikTok, OnlyFans, social media, podcast, Twitch, Instagram, all that. It's all losing something in its constant revolutions and forward motion. Again, I know this might sound shocking. The internet's such a mainstay of our lives that we forget that it's not really that old and that it definitely won't keep going the way it's going. And so cultural output is seeking new pathways to be born, new ways to connect, to die, to transform. So in this conversation, Caitlin and I aren't just considering the platforms themselves, but what people are able to connect to through the platforms and the content. So it's not just the hosting of the content, and it's not even just the content itself. It's that there's a culture that's looking for new ways to connect with meaning, and people there looking for new ways to create those kinds of meaningful connections. So since this is episode 250, instead of just talking about death and funerals with Caitlin, but there's plenty of that. There's plenty of episodes of Caitlin and I talking about death and funerals and corpses and anatomy and all that. We're talking about what being in this work is like, with hopes that it will create pathways forward for meaning and connection. The way we frame this is by discussing the quote unquote dream job. So like leftists and progressives are much more able these days to talk about how loving what you do is a lie. There's a broader awareness of that. And we're also becoming more aware of the ways that corporations and companies try to ameliorate real reflection and demands for higher wages and better conditions via perks like organic cereal dispensers or like funny hat day, whatever, and other forms of, you know, glitzy dross. But those conversations about that awareness, about that growing awareness, as important as they are, I think they sometimes reduce what could be fuller conversations. They reduce them to a political economy dimension or a political rights dimension, which doesn't consider the feeling, the culture, the individual, and what needs to be done on those levels. One site of labor where all this is so evident, where we can see a lot, is the dream job. What I mean by that is the job that's really seems enviable. It's talked about as if it's this great thing, being a YouTube star, being a writer, a podcaster, an adult performer, being an actor in film and TV and more. So since Caitlin and I worked in various forms of that, we talk about how the landscape has changed, where it's going, and mostly how this particular form of work that we do is emblematic for that dream job that is always elevated and belittled simultaneously in our society. This is always freeing and exhausting. That's life-giving and soul-killing. My hope is that you'll reflect on your own work and your dreams as you listen, and that this will inspire us to talk quite a bit more about how to make our artistic efforts, our creative efforts, more free and easier to engage with, while at the same time dissolving the grind of content creation. It's, you know, just a start for those kinds of conversations. And I hope it offers that to you. Happy 250 episodes to this crazy, exhausting, fun, enlivening thing, this podcast. Thank you for being along for the ride. This is where I say this thing that I've been saying for 7 years again and again, and I'm going to say it again now, which is please support the show on patreon.com/ConnorHabib. It's funny to me, like I've been repeating this line, and I know that that's part of the problem in a lot of ways. It's always a pitch, and that's frustrating to me. It's not as frustrating as having sponsors or ads or anything like that, monetizing the content, because there's a real relationship on Patreon. But it is frustrating to me that like that has to be part of making this show, and that I have to say it. So probably you've heard me, if you are a longtime listener, you've heard me say it so many times that you just kind of blot it out, or maybe even skip past this part where I say go to patreon.com/ConnorHabib and support the show. But I guess I'm going to keep doing it. There are other ways to support the show as well, or in addition, I should say, because that is preferable, you know, subscribing to the show, giving it a 5-star rating and a warm review on Apple Podcasts, subscribing on Spotify, and also buying my novel Hawk Mountain and giving that a 5-star rating and a warm review, a positive review on Goodreads, et cetera, et cetera, all that stuff. But, yeah. Out of all the things that I've said that have changed and grown over the years, I guess some of the forms, they just stay the same. They stay kind of stuck in place, but we'll find new ways for that too. Until then, that's the best way to support the show. I guess until then, you'll be hearing me say this right before that music that I co-wrote with Jeb Havens and then Ben Chasney from Six Word Admittance kicks in. And that's going to happen right now. Hi, everybody. It's Against Everyone with Connor Habib. Welcome back, Caitlin Doty. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Okay. So I think first things first, let's just say you've disappeared from sight in a lot of ways, in some ways not, but like you took a sabbatical, and that's something I want to talk about and center a conversation around this in a way, the idea of taking off work for quite a long time, or taking off of obligation, responsibility. I don't know. I mean, we've talked about it personally, but like, how would you describe one, why you did what you did? And then we can get into the experience, the experience that you're still undergoing.
Yeah. I'm like a cryptid. I'm sneaking around the edge of society.
Not it's actually working. Just really blurry on my screen right now. I've tried to do some grabs.
You see me out of the corner of your eye and you're like, surely that can't be someone not working. That's
with just one extra long arm as she turns away and wanders into the woods.
Yeah. I wonder what type of cryptid I would be. Something fuzzy, I hope. So yes, I, at one point a year ago, I owned a funeral home. I was working on legalizing human composting in various states. I was one of the people running a nonprofit for funeral reform. I was writing a book, which I ultimately scrapped, and I was making long-form YouTube documentaries, like 50 minutes long, that I traveled for and did heavy research for with a team. And even at the time, like there was never any misunderstanding that I wasn't doing too many things or that I wasn't, you know, overextended and that these were actually very different types of job and work. And I was always just sort of like, I think many of us just like, but you know, I'm really needed for all of them. Mm-hmm. I really have to do all these things. And I was very defensive about it in a way I think a lot of people probably listening to you will resonate with, that when someone suggests like, hey, maybe you could take a little break on this, you're just like, well, yeah, that would be nice for you. It's a lot of like, that would be nice for you. I'm sure you could do that. The way that it shows up a lot, and I've had this conversation with you like 40 times, is like getting off Twitter.
Right. That's where the overwhelm locates itself for some reason is, and I mean, we can talk about that. Why does it look like, oh, I need to take a break from social media, but actually that is maybe not, I'm not saying don't do that, but that maybe is not actually where the site of real action is.
Right. But you can also, you can, I think, locate how bad it is for you is if someone suggests, hey, maybe just take a break for Twitter. And you're like, yeah, that would be nice for you. That would be nice for you. But my business and my life and my advocacy requires this. And if you find yourself getting, and there's some truth to that to some people, I'm not trying to negate that. But like, if you are that violently intensely resistant and sort of angry to someone even suggesting that, and you can't imagine getting off Twitter for like a month, then you're probably down bad in your situation. And so what ultimately happened is I went on a weekend with two friends to kind of work on ourselves a little bit and our spiritual improvement. And they're both much more spiritually aligned than I am. I brought like chips and wine, and they brought like bags of spiritual accoutrement to spread out everywhere.
Just children's and bones.
Yeah, exactly. The bones of children, Eye of Newt, which actually was great for sabbaticals. and what happened is finally I had admitted, like it came out of my mouth, like I had never thought of it or never realized it before. It was like, I really need a break. And once I decided that I was going to take this very sincere work break, I immediately, like that afternoon, got violently ill for 2 days. And who knows if I ate some shrimp or if it was just a whole body reaction. My immune system was so fried at that point.
Both. Like that's the psychoanalytic thing. Like your product will be like, you'll seek out the bad shrimp, you know, and like there'll be something in you that's like, this is bad, but you'll eat it anyway. You know, this like you'll find a way.
This tastes weird, but I want a sabbatical. But yeah, and then that was 6 months ago. That was 6 or 7 months ago at this point. And it's tough because I don't want to be a poster child for sabbatical. And we can talk more about this, but I can already hear people like, again, like, oh, that's good for you. Oh, that's so privileged. How did you even manage that? If I could manage that, of course I would do it. And I guess part of why I want to do it or want to say something about it is like your contention that if you could do it, you would is not true.
Right.
There are a lot of people who can do it and
who aren't
doing it and who should do it because it would be better for their work and the world if they did.
Yeah. And I mean, there's a big difference. I mean, I think actually like talking about it on this show, and you did put a few things out for people that follow you on Patreon or Patreon patrons and that sort of thing, but putting it out there that you're also thinking about what this means and what it offers, I do think that actually has value. I know that that's something that maybe people don't think of right away, but when they think about, can I do a sabbatical? Is it fair? Is it okay? Is it even ethical to do one when other people are working so hard? I think actually it's the idea for me is always like with whatever my work life is, which doesn't look like most other people's work lives, I want to make what the good parts of what I do more available for everybody else. And the only way to do that is one, to do them, but then also to talk about them, demystify them, and help people think about what parts they could engage with in their own lives. And so I think it's like, you know, the idea of just talking about this at all is helpful for others. It really is helpful for others. I don't know what's going to happen in this conversation because you and I have talked about all of this like many times before you did it. And of course, during, and there's just so much. So just so people know, like Caitlin and I were trying to figure out what we wanted to talk about on this episode, maybe a week or 2 weeks ago or something. And she brought up the sabbatical and she's like, I have so many thoughts. And I was like, really? And then we talked for like an hour and just about like tons of different points without even thinking about how they would relate to the episode. So I know it's just so rich with so many different directions to go in work, in a sense of value, in how the actual work you do with death, like relates to parts of what you're experiencing on sabbatical. And for me too, just not having a standard kind of job. It just like so much came up. I was very excited, but I was also sort of shocked at how much arose out of that.
I think that our main, main thesis that we came to in that conversation was the idea that so many people now have work that's not bounded by any institution. Mm-hmm. That's just, you're a freelancer or you're a content creator, such a weird phrase, but you're making things, you're making all sorts of things. You're writing, you're reporting, you're podcasting, you're making videos, you're making social media. You're just someone who's making all sorts of things. And the idea that it used to be that if you were a writer, a successful writer or a not successful writer, you were a writer or you were a filmmaker, if you were very prolific, you made one thing a year. You put out one book, you know, unless you're John Grisham and have a stable of people doing it for you. You put out one book every 2 years, maybe.
Yeah.
You know, Donna Tartt every 12 years.
Yeah, right.
you made a film every couple of years. And now that we have these jobs and all of these mediums to put them out, it's just sort of like you make things all the time and you never stop. And if you experience any sort of success at all, where something that you make is resonating with people, or it's making any sort of money, or it allows you to quit your 9-to-5, it's just like, well, you've started now, and stopping? Mm-mm.
Yeah.
And everything is designed to make you just keep making things without pause indefinitely for the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. And I do think now people, but like nobody wants to hear someone who makes content on YouTube or who podcasts go like, I need a break, guys. Because you're like, oh, you already have the best job. Shut up. So although I do think there's a little bit of a shift in that. And people realizing that I think honestly, it's because now so many people do that there's now enough of a chorus of voices being like, this is unsustainable to always be creatively, have your creative output be so consistent and intense in its schedule that it's just not, and it's not good. And it's not, it just turns into crap.
Yeah.
That's the biggest issue, is that like every, when you keep on the churn, what you make becomes awful, even if you had an interesting idea in the first place.
It's like the great classic example we have of it is 1001 Arabian Nights, where the person is like, I'll tell you a story every night so you don't kill me, you know, and that's actually become the model of creating fiction and YouTube videos and podcasts and everything now. And I mean, I think maybe one of the places I want to go with this is the ways in which the stuff we make is so entangled in all of that, not just in the urge to do it. I do want to talk about that more too. And like the demand that you're every week, something's coming out, that there's so much there. But also I was just thinking, if you remember when Elon Musk bought Twitter and there was so much freak out about it. And I stood back and I was like, how the fuck did we get to this point where so many of the artistic forms of expression that, you know, that are great ways to work, great ways to spend your time, noble efforts, become wrapped up on these platforms and their expectations. And so that was something I wrote about right away on Twitter, was like, you know, why is the publication industry so like freaked out about Twitter going away? Like, so much of what comes out because publishers see someone who has like 25,000 Twitter followers is like, oh, maybe that person should write a memoir. They're selecting and curating based on things that actually have nothing to do with art. So it, I just want to add that part in where the way that content creation is also offline tied into the ways that people curate and make demands on artists as well. So even if you're not the person that's like online with that grind all the time, people are looking to that, you know, to produce art in other forms.
Absolutely. One of the things we know about publishing specifically is that maybe if you're a novelist, you can get away with being somewhat unknown, but any sort of nonfiction or memoir that you want to write, the first thing they will ask is, what is your platform? What is your platform? Show me your full platform. Show me how much engagement you have. Show me how many followers you have on each platform. And that's been a real barrier to entry to probably some really smart, interesting work over the years. But now with things like TikTok and the way that the algorithms are, you see people who just, they're like, I do the puppy dance. And they're like wearing a little dog costume. And they're like, we're at 900,000 on TikTok. Or we're at, you know, like over 2 million followers on all platforms. And it's just absolute like it feels like Twilight Zone, because it's like weird, repetitive crap. And you're like, wait, this person is our cultural touchstone. Like, this person is followed by millions of people. And it's just actually counterintuitively become very easy to be followed by millions of people on certain platforms.
My boyfriend has a friend who, I mean, this isn't a bad about her, but she, he knew her when he was younger, I guess. And she did this video that was like, I'm going to put a layer of icing on for every 10 on this cake for every like 1,000 followers I get or something like that. And then I'm going to cut it when I reach 100,000. And so she got 100,000 followers in like 4 days, you know, or something crazy like that. And everybody was just waiting for her to cut the cake. And then she cut the cake. And that was that. Like, then you could see the layers of icing. And it was cool. Like, it was a cool little experiment. And then there was all this like talk in her comments about, who else is like leaving now that they saw this? And then people like, well, I'm staying because she did this creative thing. I mean, it's just like trying to pull people in to see the cake being cut, honestly, you know? And then what do you have after that? And I don't, of course, I don't blame her. Like, it's not to begrudge her. That's the way that version of economy works. And so why wouldn't you?
She just sold a nonfiction memoir.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Cutting the cake.
With her 102,000 followers.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's like, but I think we all are aware of the frustrating dissonance between who has a lot of followers and how that ends up with book contracts, or even like the ability to keep making things for a living and not have another job, you know, whether it's getting brand deals or whether it's getting some sort of revenue from these platforms and being able to continue, you know, does she get to quit her job, her like terrible job at some tech company or, right, you know, some HR company because she put 45 layers on a cake.
Right.
And if she does, are we like, yes, queen, you did it? Or are we like, actually that says something bad about society? I don't know. I don't have an answer for that.
Well, I think what you're pointing to, which I think is really important, is that, you know, we like saying yes, queen, to someone doing that, of course, on a political level, I am totally on board with that. You know, I mean, the way that the system is set up for people to work is absolutely insane. But on a cultural level, I object to it. And so I think that's where we find the dissonance. It's like, or the, like, there's some sort of rupture between those two things. I don't want to just accept bad culture to change the, you know, I don't accept bad culture as a trade-off for changing some aspects and really ultimately not really changing them in the political landscape. You know, I mean, I think about this with OnlyFans all the time, where people, they're really like just putting out content constantly, and it's getting them somewhere kind of like, maybe they can almost pay rent, you know, or maybe they can supplement the income that they already have to live in a big city. And that's fine. But like, I'm sure a lot of those people, just knowing from my own experience, are like, oh my God, I've had to turn my entire like life of desire and sexuality into my job now. And some of the stuff I'm proud of putting out and some of it I'm not. And so like, that's not a trade-off either. Like that's not actually improving the political situation ultimately. Even though it looks like people have seized the means of production or, you know, opted out in some ways of having a boss. But ultimately, I think more just to the point of the cake thing, it's like, I don't think having shit culture is like, I don't want to say it's worth or not worth having a better political system. But how do we strive for both when we don't even talk about trying to have both at the same time, much less trying to have both and like a reasonable economic system?
Well, politically, there's something like eye twinkling and exciting about trying to believe that this woman with the cake layers, who of course I don't know, and like, you know,
she's great. Hi, we think you're great.
She's become a symbol for us. Yeah. Here. Like there's this kind of beautiful idea of her trolling the whole time and like being right. Like in this absolute fantasy world. And I think this is some ways the fantasy world of OnlyFans too, is the idea that like with a twinkle in your eye and a spring in your step, you hack into a system and make a ton of money at very little difficulty to yourself or to your spirituality or to your sense of self in the world. And you're like, guess what? I got to quit my job and put frosting on a cake, you little fuckers. Like, yeah. I figured it out. Wink, wink. And I think that's how a lot of people talk about OnlyFans, too, is that like, and actually a lot of content creation in general.
And YouTube videos and podcasts and like, yes. And writing and the things that we do. I mean, I think
if you don't like, do it, there's this idea that you're like, like, yeah, I've right. done it, you little freaks. And like, I've hacked the system and now I make money and I'm so sorry you have to go to your little job. Which, and it, like, in a way, yeah. that's the yes queen. Like, I wish that's how it was. I wish that like this woman putting the layers on the cake, it was more like that and not like the 1001 Nights, that she's not like,
right. Yeah.
Just being like, now that she's put layers on the cake, she has to keep putting layers on the cake forever until it falls over on her and she drowns in cake.
Right. That's actually the perfect image, is that like next time it's 1,000 layers of icing and then it's 2,000, you know, and I think that that's exactly, you know, speaks to some of the things that our, you know, our challenges here, is that I do feel like what I do is in some ways a fuck you to the regular wage labor relationship. And I'm proud of that. I'm happy that that's true. On the other hand, I'm like fucking busting my ass constantly just to like, sometimes just to tread water. Sometimes I'm better off. Like if a big check comes in for something, then I'm good for a little while. But then it's just like, I'm back in that. And leaving aside my complicated relationship with money, which you've not talked about many times, I'm sure a lot of people find themselves in that situation where it's like, well, yeah, I would never want to enter into a specific kind of job that demands me to show up here for this amount of time to this amount of time and all that sort of stuff. But how do I, and then when I'm like, I'm not in that, screw that, I hate that. Oh, by the way, I'm working like tons. And then when people are like, well, yeah, you're just a podcaster, another white boy with a podcast, you know, I'm not fully white, so that's not fair. But it's like, but then for someone to lay that at my feet, or for to you be like, well, you're just a YouTube star, or, you know, whatever it is. Then you're like, the retort is like, well, I work really hard. You have no idea how hard I work. So it's this trap, like, where there's no good option for response to, you know, what you might be proud of and what your circumstances are.
Well, it's an absolute trap. I've been in the funeral industry for 15, 16 years. My entire adult life has been spent in the funeral industry. And I started pretty early on doing public funeral reform work and making videos. And immediately the response from older funeral directors, mostly men, although women have really gotten in on the act too, is, you know, she just wants to be a star. She just wants attention. She's basically just a YouTuber. And like, first of all, being a YouTuber is harder than being a funeral director. Sorry about it. I mean, it depends on who you are. Depends on who you are. Like, there's, if you have difficulty with death and difficult human emotions, being a funeral director is incredibly difficult.
Right, right.
But I've done a lot of work on myself to be able to hold those, to hold that sadness for people, and to be present, and to see death as a gift, and have it not be some horrible negative, I'm surrounded by dead bodies thing when I owned a funeral home. But that compared to the amount, you know, and you might have one person at a funeral home say, oh, I don't like how you made my mother look, or I don't like this funeral was run poorly, or you might have just some complaint at a funeral home from a family. And someplace like YouTube, you can have complaints about what a terrible person you are from thousands of people in one day.
Right. Yeah.
That is more than available to you. And that's always a threat that comes with it. And so the idea that, oh, you're just, you know, making YouTube videos is the trap, because especially when you start doing that when you're young and everybody is telling you you have the best job in the world and it's actually really easy. And you're like, I feel like it's not easy. Like, I feel like it's, I feel like it's difficult, and I feel like it does a lot of stuff to your mental health. And I feel like it's a strange grind. And I feel like it's hard to relate to other people about this particular thing. And then you have, you know, old funeral directors, for instance, saying, this is just a weird little vanity project you're doing. It's very strange. And then it goes on for 15 years, you know, in my case. Like, it's very strange. I mean, I've learned a lot about myself through the process, but I think there really is something there about anybody who does this kind of work that's outside of the system, whether it's OnlyFans, whether it's a podcast, whether it's writing, whether it's YouTube, whatever it is. To do it and to experience it and to know that you're, like, you know, hashtag blessed in a lot of ways, but it's also really, really hard. And just the constant messaging of, it's actually not hard.
Right.
What you do is not hard. Like, just the, and then you just have to do this, like, elaborate pantomime of how hard it is. And then right. I think this is something that I would always come back to in the kind of years leading up to taking a sabbatical, and just being like, wait a second, I believe fundamentally that people shouldn't have to work that hard. Mm-hmm. I think nobody should be working that hard. We shouldn't be working as long as we are. We shouldn't be working as hard as we are. I believe that deep in my bones. And yet I feel an absolute need to just do a little dance about how fucking hard I'm working, because otherwise I'm not justified to be in my position at all.
Well, yes. So there's so much there. Like, I do want to talk about that, demonstrating the pain of how difficult it all is. I mean, that's partially set up by, you know, an increasing It seems to have actually leveled out a little bit, but by a culture that is increasingly demanding of the deepest levels of victimhood and violation to even hear that anybody is in pain or having a hard time or having difficulty. And so people broadcast things, in ways that are like massive because they know that they won't be heard otherwise. And so we're all part of that. We all feel like I have to show exactly how absolutely hard this is to garner any kind of sympathy and to be let off the hook. That seems to have intensified over the past like 15 years or something like that. Like I said, I think it's leveled off in a little bit because world problems are so massive right now that there are very clearly demonstrable worst case scenarios going on but I think that's part of it. But I also think, when you're talking about, well, it's hard. Oh, couldn't anybody do it? And then, add in the complication that like most podcasts, most books, and most YouTube channels are pretty bad. And the reason why a lot of them are bad is because people don't work hard enough on them or don't put enough concern and thoughtful effort into them. Well, and so this is even tricky to like articulate around, because I don't want to imply that people should be bossing their asses so hard and that's what will make it good. Cause some people do that and it's still not good. And some people are really like effortlessly good at things. And people shouldn't have to work that hard. But the fact of the matter is most of them are bad. So what do we do? How do we even include that?
This is a thing that I completely understand that I sound like an old grouch, and I am.
Because I am.
Because I 100% am. And even taking a sabbatical has not lifted the cloud of grouchiness that I have around certain opinions that I have. Which is that a lot of the thing that has kept me going making things, and I think you making things for so long, is that we come from like a very intense advocacy, true believer background. Mm-hmm. Like we really believe that. I mean, I think me especially, not that I believe more than you, but that I just wouldn't do it if I wasn't. I'm not particularly well aligned or good at being a public figure, but my just like a fiery, almost religious fervor for changing how we see the dead body and the funeral industry has made me be in this position for so long. And not that everybody, because like some people should just, if they're funny and interesting and like you said, kind of effortlessly good at presenting or being on camera or being on a microphone, and they're just a good time, they're just putting icing on a cake and you're just like, oh, I feel better. Those people should do things. And people who really believe in things, even if they're not a particularly natural fit, should probably be making things and putting out things and trying to put things into the world. But there's this whole vast category of people who are neither of those things, right, and don't really have a purpose for making content or things, and don't really have a talent, but are just torturously trying to make it work because being a creator or a podcaster is just something they want to be so badly. And they feel like there's money that's going to come with it and prestige that's going to come with it. And they just want it so badly that they're really like square pegging into a round hole, and it just clogs. And even going on Instagram or going on Twitter or going on YouTube, you just feel the absolute glut of people just trying to make this work for themselves, but there's no spark behind the eyes.
Yeah.
And it's tough to watch.
Yeah, and obviously a lot of those people want it because the other work situations are so terrible that they don't want to be in those work situations. I think it's to the point where a lot of content generation is so mystified that people don't understand that that can be actually also a terrible and exhausting form of work. So, you know, the illusory aspects of this being easy, like that doesn't serve anybody. It just doesn't serve anybody to say that that's true. But I was also thinking about when you said, it's like that people who aren't clear on their motivations, it's okay to do things when you're not clear on your motivations either. Sometimes you don't know until you try and you try and succeed and fail and succeed again or whatever. And then you gain some clarity on your motivations. But there are lots of people that are just doing things because they don't exactly know why they're doing it. They're not looking into what it offers. I think a lot about like people who are on Shark Tank or Dragon's Den or whatever, and they come in with some like bonkers, like whack-a-mole invention. And they're like, I would like $200,000 for a 2% stake in my company, you know? And it's like, and they're like, and I mean, not that I'm, a huge fan of these like multimillionaire investors, but they're like, what? Like, why are you doing this? You know, you obviously have passion and you have an excitement, but like it's funneling into the wrong thing, you know, and you can just kind of see it. And I don't know. I think then for you to take a sabbatical, like after knowing all, like after really being kind of clear on your motivation and everything, I'm wondering if some of that time off is about, well, I need to step back and look at my motivations again. I need to look at my why. I need to look at if this is actually the best place to direct my energy. If I'm able to keep up anymore. And if I'm not, what does it mean? You know, where do I put this excitement and enthusiasm for the things I really deeply care about? Because I think about that all the time. You know, I changed my life from making movies and making scenes, and I knew that I was going to lose something by changing over. I knew that I didn't want to do it anymore. That was quite clear to me. But I also knew that it offered me things that it really fulfilled certain parts of my life. And how was I going to get those? How was I going to deal with not having them fulfilled by that kind of work? And, you know, so I'm thinking about all that too, when you're thinking about taking a break, the shift and the reassessment and the, well, what have I lost? What do I need? Can I create it in a new way? Can I recreate what's been given to me?
Well, when your own boss, I mean, think about it, like you're anybody who is working in a job where they have bosses. When you step away from that, you don't have no boss. Mm-hmm. You have yourself as a boss, and you have like the algorithm or the publishing industry as your boss. So you don't actually have no boss. You have like potentially worse bosses, mm-hmm. which are the prison of your own mind, mm-hmm. and how you treat yourself, and the algorithms. And there was a certain point where, but I guess it was a year or so ago, that YouTube really did. I won't go into the whole story, but YouTube really screwed us over on a documentary that we just put our little heart and souls into. Just it worked with. It was about the Eastland, which was a boat that capsized in the Chicago River, and the story is not untold, but has not even a fraction of the attention that it deserves for all the elements at play in it. And I think that there was a dead body that was shown on screen for like a second too long, and they completely banned the video. And it was a whole huge thing. And the hardest part was I couldn't speak. There's no one at YouTube. I couldn't speak to anyone. I couldn't engage with anyone. They're essentially my boss and held all the power for whether or not this thing that we had spent months making could be distributed. Mm-hmm. And they were just not there. It's like if, you know, something horrible happened at your job and you're like, oh, I got to go to my boss's office, and the door was just locked and there was no boss there.
And that's for you. I mean, that's for someone who's extremely successful and has brought a lot of money to YouTube ultimately, you know.
Yeah, they don't, unless you're literally Mr. Beast, you don't have, mm-hmm. you know, any contact or anyone at YouTube to help you, except like a series of very strange robots that make you lose your mind a little bit. And So, I mean, going back to what you were saying, there was just this feeling of, even if I do put my heart and soul into this, am I doing it all under the thumb of this labyrinthian tech company that I don't even have any contact mm-hmm. in and no real place in, and is capricious beyond even my understanding of what they could be? And so that was part of what really discouraged me, but ultimately like drove me to take this sabbatical. And there is absolutely a fear, though, everything. So spoiler alert, I still technically own my funeral home, but I basically gave it away mm-hmm. to another young woman who's doing an amazing job. I stepped away from the nonprofit. I scrapped the book entirely, including canceling the contract. And I stopped making YouTube videos and stopped doing any media or interviews for the last 6 months. And it wasn't like that clean, you know, it wasn't just like one day I stopped it all. Like it took a while to disentangle from all of that. But there was absolutely many months of fear of, exactly like you said, what do all these things do for me? What do they offer me? If I don't own a funeral home, can I even talk about, do I have any right to talk about funeral home reform? If I don't, you know, it doesn't matter how long I've worked in the funeral industry or how much of an expert I am or how long I've owned various funeral homes. If I don't own one right now, does that mean I can't speak out about funeral industry reform? If I am not actively traveling around the country making these documentaries, do I deserve anybody supporting me or giving me money if I'm not doing the pantomime of how hard I'm working? You know, if I'm not writing a book right now in the trenches, am I a writer? Do I get, like, it completely messes with your sense of self and who you are and what you call yourself. And I will say, though, that the longer that you step away from those things, it's the only way to see how entangled you are with them and move away from them.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think anybody who's been in the public eye that has sort of a fear of being canceled, right? And that's thankfully also diminished a bit too. They will have these thoughts like, well, what would I do instead? You know, like try to protect themselves by like, well, just be a sheep farmer in Bulgaria or something like that. And so you begin to romanticize other forms of work, which is already completely weird, that like the mind is like, what else could I do for work? You know, but also, when people find themselves in situations where they want to take a break, I think sometimes they start having fantasies about being forced to take a break, that something will show up and like fuck things up. You know, being canceled is one, cancer is another. You know, like I have someone in my family who's just like, was at least for years, like terrified of getting cancer. And I was like, it sounds like you just want a break. Like, it sounds like you just, you know, they didn't get cancer, at least not yet, by the way. So it's not like I was being an asshole, but it was like, you know, the way that they were describing, because I was like, well, what would happen? And they were like, well, you know, wouldn't be able to watch the kids. I don't know what I would do for work. I just have to like lay in bed and like heal. And I was like, sounds like those are all things you want. Like, you know, and so people come up with disastrous inductions into taking a break. But then interestingly, then when you get the break, you can also feel lost and aimless and not exactly know what to do. I fantasize about having a break all the time, but I don't really want a break from writing. Like I have to say, you know, I love writing. Like it's so fulfilling for me. And in fact, if I fantasize about taking a break, I'm like, I just want to move to a cabin and write a book, a philosophy book that nobody understands. You know, that's my fantasy about what a break would look like. But I do fantasize about taking breaks from, you know, writing, coaching, from the podcast, from doing events, from trying to just keep all the balls in the air, all that kind of stuff. And it's not because I don't like those things. I do like them, but I definitely fantasize about taking a break. And, you know, and so my fantasy again is like this kind of weird isolation, you know. So I'm wondering, I guess, as I'm kind of wandering through all these thoughts of my own, I'm wondering if you were fantasizing about a way that this would look beforehand, and if that ultimately has been satisfying. Or, oh, I mean, I know some of the answer to this, but like, 10, talk about
1,000%. It. Yeah. So because I started this when I was, looking back, so young, you know, 23, 24, I was 23 when I got into the funeral industry, and I was immediately like, this is my job. This is my passion. This is reform work I want to do. I haven't honestly changed my kind of core beliefs since I was 23 or 24. And so I've been involved in this for so long. And when I finally made the decision, and I had the exact experience, I mean, you've experienced me experiencing this. I've had the exact experience where I've sort of have been like, well, I haven't done anything wrong, but I could be canceled at any second. Right. And that might, and then you're sort of like, that wouldn't that be, isn't that kind of secretly what you want? So you can just have a little break.
Sorry, I'm not asshole friend, everybody, but
no. It's very helpful. What is the story you told me about the dog? How you should just get a dog?
Oh, it's an Anthony Jeselnik. It was an Anthony Jeselnik joke where he was was on stage, and he saw some woman that had a dog sitting in the front row. And so, if you don't know Anthony Jeselnik, like, he's a really harsh edged comedian, and he was on stage, and there was someone sitting in the front row with a German Shepherd, like, next to her, and he could see that she wasn't blind, you know, like. And he just finally stopped the show, and he's like, I'm sorry, like, what the fuck is up with that dog? And the woman said, well, I was horribly abused by my husband. He just was terrible. And now this dog is my companion animal. I take him with me everywhere I go, you know, because my husband just brutally abused me. And then he just paused for a second. And he said, you know, there are easier ways to get a dog, you know? and of course she laughs. She's at the Anthony Jeselnik show. He knows what kind of humor she's in for. Yeah. And, but I mean, that is the thing. It's like, there are easier ways to get the dog, you know?
Yes.
And, you know, another way of saying it is, like, I said to my friend Heather Berg, like, she was just constantly like fretting about getting getting a job under capitalism. She's like a total Marxist, and she was like fret about getting this job. And I was like, Heather, like, capitalism's bad enough. Like, you being miserable isn't going to actually change the landscape for how successful you are as a Marxist. And she's like, oh yeah. So, you know, it's the same sort of thing. Like, why are we having fantasies of violence and I don't know, degradation, failure, all that amongst those things already happening? Like, actually, it might be better to have a different kind of fantasy, you know?
Right. Yeah. Why does my fantasy have to be like, well, when everything is taken from me,
right,
when all, right, like, when all respect and all my hard work is stripped from my, like, shivering body at the bottom of a well, then I can, like, have a cup of cocoa and read a book, right, you know? Right. Like, well, you could just have a cup of cocoa and read a book.
Then I shall be the little match girl. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, exactly. When I'm selling matchbooks on a Victorian street corner, right, then I shall begin the journey to know thyself. Yeah, I mean, when I took the sabbatical, I definitely had some ideas of what was going to happen. And a lot of it involved, I think my picture of it involved a very, what I expected was going to happen was like a very deep sort of contemplative depression, you know, where I just like lay in bed for 2 months doing nothing. And then I would emerge and I would discover I was actually a very different person than I thought I was. And it would be sort of late summer, early fall at this point, and I would wander the lilac fields and I would curl up and I would just imagine my body rotting into the soil. And then I would get up and I would collect some flowers and I would go home and make some tinctures with the flowers and make a tea from it and make some oils to heal myself. And I would drink some tea and I would stare into the middle distance. And I would, in that space that was created, new ideas and new things would flood in that would tell me I was a completely different person than the person that I thought that I was. And I had never given myself space for those things to come in. And let me tell you, Connor, that is not what happened. What happened is none of that. It was just sort of hanging out for like 4 months. There was never any deep depression. Some people do have it if they're really, really burnt out. So, you know, your results may vary on how this happens, but I just sort of hung out. I can't even really remember what I did. I felt sort of like vaguely bad and confused for a couple of months. Watched a lot of like random TV, wandered around, did very little. And then my exact same passions that I had before started to come back. And there was a different flavor to them. But it turns out I'm the exact same person that I was before sabbatical. I don't have any new hobbies. I don't have any new passions. I didn't change my life that drastically in any way.
She didn't send me tinctures.
I made no tinctures. I still want to make tinctures. I still just really see myself as someone who makes tinctures. But what did happen is that I came up with one big project that I'm now starting to work on, which I haven't said what it is yet, but you know, it's not wildly different than what I was doing before. It's of a piece of what I was doing. It's about spoilers, about dead bodies. But I came back to a place where I actually feel like I am someone who loves the history of the dead body in our culture. That is fundamentally who I am. I'm fundamentally pretty good at transmitting that enthusiasm and that knowledge to other people. It's something I really care about. I have ways to do it, and I want to continue to do that work, but I want to do it in a different way, and I want to really protect my peace in all ways around it. And if I had not done the sabbatical... So the sabbatical to me, in sum, my sabbatical was an opportunity to not become a different person, not live a different life, but return to my life just so stripped of noise and crap and baggage, just gunk in layers that I didn't realize was so thick. Let's say I was a cake. And let's say over the years, I had put 100 layers of frosting of just absolute extraneous crap over myself. And then I hit 100,000 followers. I took my sabbatical and I got to cut in to myself and see the cake that was once again inside. But what I will say is that it's really tough to just tell people, oh, take a break, because it takes a while. At least in my case, it did. It wasn't like I took 2 weeks off and the first week was a little strange, but then the second week I felt great. Like that can help a little bit, but that is not.
Now that's a vacation.
You really need the like 3 months to 4 months to either. And I've read stuff. So I've heard different people's experiences. Sometimes there is a depression. Sometimes there is terrible anxiety. Sometimes there's just a desire to escape. And then a lot of times it's just like futzing around on your phone and doing almost nothing like I did. To really start to strip away these things and do some hard work and tiptoe back into things. Like just, and that's what really, I guess, thinking about it now, the sabbatical gives you an opportunity to do is like tip your little baby toe into something and be like, how does this feel? Because something that's happened now is that if somebody asks me to do something, or I have to do like two big things a day, or my whole body just has this visceral reaction, like, no, too much, which before I would just blast through.
Totally.
You know, 12 intense tasks every day and just be like, this is what we're doing. And now my body has like developed such a warning system.
Yeah. I mean, just to take the time component there, when I used to teach, I would do this thing with my students where I would just have, I only did it once a semester, but it was rough. I was like, look, we're just going to actually take the beginning of this class and we're just going to sit here in silence for 5 minutes. You're not going to close your eyes or put your head down on your desk. There weren't really cell phones, you know, weren't that popular at the time. So I didn't have to deal with that. But I was like, so you're not going to sleep and you're just not going to talk. You're just going to sit here and we're just all going to sit with our eyes open in silence for 5 minutes. And like the first 2 minutes of that were like, obviously just like a hellish nightmare for everybody. And then about 3 minutes in, you could see everybody was just, it was, you know, a breath was taken all. It was like by everybody. And then the rest of it was fine. But it was really hard even to just get into a few minutes of doing nothing. And that was really like, don't do anything. So it's a little different than taking a break. But then as a sort of more macro version of that, I didn't know that I didn't know how to relax until with my ex-boyfriend, we went to this place in Wellfleet that was a house with no internet. There was no cell phone signal. It was in the woods. And he would just sort of walk around, eat a sandwich, take a nap, maybe get up and just sit outside for a little bit, do nothing. And I was like, I got to finish these 5 books by the end of the week. I got to do this. I got to do that. Like I was just totally goal setting. And it was about 2 or 3 days before I was like, oh, I can just do nothing. Like, so there's that easing in period, but then also then taking it even bigger to your few months of doing this, you know, there's a question for me about like, what does it look like if Caitlin does this for 2 years? You know, what does it look like if actually it's not, you know, that's interesting to me. I mean, one of the things that you're discovering, which I think is how, going back to what we were saying earlier in the show, how entangled the things that you want to do are in systems that you are frustrated to engage with, and maybe thinking about how else to do it. I don't know. Like, I know you have a video about bodies at Harvard. And we talked about that a lot. You're like, well, if I put this out, like, do I have to keep putting it out? You know, you were just sort of questioning and asking because the system of putting out content it's such a fast and strong current that the moment you step into it, it brings up all the questions of, well, now I have to just do it the way that everybody was expecting and I have to do it like this. Like, there's not really room to be like, I'm going to make this short video because I think that this YouTube video format actually really complements some of my interests and the way that I want to do things. And it's interesting to me to do it this way. And I'm going to make this video. It's going to be good. I'm going to put it out. And I'm not going to necessarily just start up doing things the way they were again. It's hard to even wrap your head around that. I mean, the fact that you and I had so many conversations about that, just that, I mean, that shows how insanely frenetic the content current is. And it's really sucks. Maybe just one more thing on this. Like, you know, my version of noticing this is like, I put out an episode. I talked about this on the last, I did an episode that was just about podcasting, but I'll put out an episode that I think is like, it's really good. I'll have some person that's totally new to me. I think they're a great artist or a great thinker or whatever it is. We'll have a conversation which brings up new thoughts for both of us. It's exciting. It's weird. It presents all these new directions. And I know if they're new for us, they'll be new for some of the listeners, if not most of them. And I'm like, that was really gratifying. That was really beautiful. That meeting with this new person I've never spoken with before. And here it is. And then a week later, I just have to do another one. And this artifact has kind of fallen away. And it's still there. Of course, people can listen to it. But I mean, I wish it were like that sand mandala thing where it's like, it's all swept away at the end, the creation of the art. But it's not that. We are seeking to make artifacts in a way. We are seeking to make something that has an enduring value for people and that has an enduring value for us. And it's so frustrating to me that in fact, I seek ways to make more permanent in some way or make more like an artifact, the contribution of some of the episodes that I've done, because I do think that they're actually very good. Not all of them, some of them I'm not at the top of my game. And some of them are just more personal, but so that current, I just want people to understand how difficult, even after taking 6 months off or whatever, being like, I'm gonna approach that river again. It's like, oh, here I go. Bye. You know, it's so hard.
It is really hard. And I have, what I will say is that everyone around me, whether it's before the sabbatical, when everyone around me who loves me and cares about me or works with me was like, you should take a year. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I'll do my best. And it ended up being about 6 months. Although I will say, you know, completely different work style than when I left. Mm-hmm. To now, when everyone around me is just helping me put in so many guardrails so I don't do that again. And for so long, my sort of subconscious strategy was I have to make it so much less about me, Caitlin, the person, because that can't last forever. People won't be interested in me forever. I will potentially get canceled. I will, you know, there's all these things about how, okay, you need to have a backup plan that doesn't involve you at all. Just to make sure, and it wasn't, you know, sheep farming in Bulgaria, but it was, nor was it making cake videos on TikTok. Although sometimes I fantasized about making just like wild, weird content that has me not connected to it at all. And maybe I already have it up. Maybe you don't even know.
Slender Man.
Yeah. Slender Man? Yeah, that was me. That lore, basically me. Creepypasta. I came up with that term. But what I've come to and what I'm moving into now is actually leaning in to me and leaning in. That sounds like that's the title of my sabbatical memoir, is leaning into me, but it leaning into me as one little person in my hobbity hole, doing my best, making my tinctures, which are actually pieces of content or books or documentaries, and doing my just best as a single person, not as a huge company, not as a production company, not as any of that, but just as a single person, and being transparent about that and not necessarily vulnerable. I don't want to throw that around, but just being like, hey, it's me. I am a living human doing my best. Putting out things that are deeply important to me, working hard and focusing on things that really have meaning to me that I want you to see, and not presenting myself as any way in the grind. And I used to have a much larger staff that made these videos with me and at the nonprofit. And so there was always the grind of like, all these people need to be paid too. So I have to make sure that all of this is running at a high, really high level to make sure these people are all being paid quickly and fairly and, you know, and to have just be like, hi, it's me. I'm just coming to you sewing my quilt in my little burrow, you know, and having that kind of more honest, intimate relationship with just the person that is me. And this is not like, you wouldn't expect someone knitting a little blanket in a burrow to be like, okay, podcast every Monday, every Friday, why would that little creature in the burrow be like on a very intense content schedule? Yeah. Like, why would you even want that creature? That's like dissonant. You wouldn't want that creature on that schedule. So this is a metaphor I'm trotting out for the first time right now. So I'm not sure how much it's hitting, but like, I think that everyone around me is really putting up barriers to not have it go back to anything where I'm like, we're striving, we're hitting numbers. If you looking back, I never would have said I was that kind of person. Mm. You know what I mean? I didn't see myself as that kind of person. But with the time away, I'm like, oh, a lot of that really did infect me and did kind of subconsciously affect me in ways that I didn't understand.
It's so hard because, I mean, a lot of the ways in which you and I have reached whatever levels of success we have reached has been by accessing that kind of like, gotta push, gotta like schedule out every day, gotta be regimented, gotta like have this kind of mindset, the success mindset, like whatever it is. And it did work. But you, on the other side, you're left wondering which parts of that were genuine, which parts of that actually needed to be there, what didn't. And, you know, if I tried to do that now, I just don't think it would work. I don't think that that kind of push would work for me anymore. I mean, one, I'm just older, so I have less energy for it. But like, you know, I think it's also, it's not part of my integrity anymore. Like, I want the way I work to reflect my values as much as the product of my work. And that's hard to achieve. I mean, when I'm thinking about like offering people advice on this show, because I just wonder if people are listening, if they don't make content, like what are they connecting to on this? And I'm like, well, can we give some advice? And I'm like, well, in some ways, no. I mean, in some ways I can't give advice because I haven't taken the break. Not really. I try to live my life in a certain way that doesn't require a break, but I fail and I, you know, feel at least, I don't know how illusory or real this is, that I need to keep treading water with the way that I make money. And I think for you, it's like, well, I can't just export my life and my, you know, situation with finances and my structures that I sold or left behind or whatever, and just say, well, just do what I did, you know. But there is another piece here, which is about, seeing clearly the ways what you want to do and what you care about are entangled in all sorts of structures that you'd rather not be connected to, and how to sort of navigate that. And how to make more room for yourself to be able to identify that, and be able to identify when you've, you know, when you're caught in the web versus when you're actually looking at the thing that, you know, and working with the thing that you care about. That's a real mixed metaphor. That's not even really a mixed metaphor. It's just, but
no, well, there is something there, which I think is, if you've made it this far and you're listening to this and in your own head, and I hope people, as they've been listening to it, have like their brain has wandered off to another place because they're thinking about the ways that they are entangled and the things, the places they know they need to take a break. And there are certain things, I think what I would want to say is that I know I've been to this rodeo. I know how the defensiveness around this works. And you may, you listener at home, may be popping up in your mind things like, well, okay, yeah, I'm going to take a break from my kids. I'm going to take a break from, you know, my salaried job. Okay. And you're coming up with this defensiveness because you know that there are things that you need to disentangle from. And it's going to be hard to admit. So you're coming up with like silly counterfactuals to dismiss it. You know, you're coming up with like, oh, I'm supposed to just like take a break from my 10-year-old child. Okay. It's like, okay, no, but you are PTA president. Right. And you know that you hate it and you know that it like seek, or maybe even you even really like it, but it's so difficult for you. And it keeps you so entangled with your child in a way that is not actually helpful for your relationship with your child. And it would be so hard to say no to it, but ultimately very necessary. So there's just in all of our lives, there are so like taking the sabbatical allowed me in a very privileged way to discover the like 47 deep entanglements that I was working with at any given time. But like, even if you can work on five of them that you don't want to admit, and like the place that you find them is the place that you're most defensive.
Yeah.
The place that you find yourself saying like, well, I could never do that. You could do that, but I couldn't do that. I'm in a position where I am needed in this way, or I have to do this. Are you needed? Do you have to do that?
Yeah. And that's all about like, well, some of that at least is about your sense of worth and value. It's like you're talking about before. Well, people need me. You know, it's like if I'm doing spiritual work and I'm like, well, I don't want, you know, the demons from planet Zork to invade the astral bodies of everybody. So I got to keep podcasting.
Yeah. You're the one reason that's people don't realize how hard it is to keep that barrier up.
Yeah, exactly.
Us and Zork.
Sorry. Yeah. Like, I'm the Doctor Strange of this dimension. So, but I mean, I think it just has so much to do with, you know, yeah, sense of worth and sense of value. You know, when I think about what you're saying and just relate it to my own life and what I'm experiencing and going through, and I'm just thinking, well, you know, would it suck for me to hear if I wanted to take a break from podcasting, would it suck for me to hear people be like, you deserve a break. Go ahead, take a break. I think maybe there'd even be part of me that was like, wait a second. No, like, don't you guys need what I'm doing? and then there's the flip side of that where I'm like, well, I could never take a break because this is the only thing that makes me money and I'm fucked if I don't like, on a regular basis, like in a predictable way. So, and that's not even true. Like it's not the podcast, it's Patreon, which is different than the actual podcast. I don't have sponsors, you know? So it's like, but I'm like, no, there's no other way. Like there'd be no other way for me to do it with less time commitment, with less, you know, whatever. And that's also, it's not true it can't be true if I don't investigate it, you know, and it's uninvestigated really. And I'm not saying I'm doing those things or like that. I would stop doing the podcast like tomorrow if I could or whatever. It's not like that, but there's a lot of stuff that I'm just not uncovering. And I think people here in Ireland, people are kind of low ambition in Ireland. That's not to say that nobody has it, but it's not like the US where it's like, do what you dream, Sebastian. That's the never ending story. You know, it's much more like, don't get notions. Don't get, you know, like don't go and try to do this thing. You'll probably fail, etc. But I find people really reflexively defensive about doing the things they want in a way that's so obvious and easy for me to see, like why they're doing that. And it has a lot to do with a sense of self-worth, you know, low sense of self-worth, self-value, all that kind of stuff. And not wanting to rise above some sort of agreed upon idea that everybody should be at least a little bit, you know, kind of unhappy at all times, you know? And so, I can see it in others, and it has to do with this is what, you know, this is what I think of myself. And this is the low opinion I have of myself, or the too high opinion, which is also another version of being defensive.
Well, it's, I mean, maybe because I am American, part of me is like, don't tell me not to have notions. And like, it's okay to have ambition. And I think it is okay to have ambition, but you just need to very brutally check in with yourself and be like, is this ambition, does this come from me? Is it still coming from me?
Right.
Like, what's the source of this ambition? Is it because I have a very real societal project that I'm working on, that I'm enacting in the best way possible? Or is it an ambition that's gotten quite tainted with all sorts of other outside forces and entanglements that I wasn't aware of? And if you don't step back, your ambition, which can start out very sweet, can morph into something that's deeply entangled with negative things. And that's sort of, I guess, you know, the advice is just, okay, so you didn't like save like a little squirrel on a rainy day for a long time to be able to take a sabbatical like I did. you feel like you don't have the money or the space to do so. Okay, so you can't do that exactly that, but can you start even just committing to a month of really deeply looking at something that you're really entangled with and say like, what are the worst case scenarios? Exactly like you said, like if I stop doing this, if I stop being the PTA president, which is a straight, I'm sure no one who listens to your show is the PTA president. I don't know where
you'd
I came
surprised.
Up with that.
You'd be surprised.
Yeah. A lot of just sweet, sweet moms. Listen to Against Everyone, but you're PTA president, like what would it mean if you didn't get that power trip anymore? You didn't get that sort of feedback. You didn't have that kind of structure. You didn't have that work. You didn't have that meaning. Like what if that was all gone? And like that was actually ended up being fine and freed you up in a lot of ways. There's just a lot of ways that we are. And now I just sound like there's a lot of ways we don't know that we're tangled up and under the thumb, man.
Yeah.
But like it's true. That's true. Like there's just so many ways we are entangled in our lives that we do not have the space to examine, and that we're so hyper defensive about for whatever reason.
And there's no training.
Allow ourselves to step back from them.
Yeah, sorry, I just didn't mean to interrupt, but there's no training. Like no one helps you articulate what that is. So like, cause I'm thinking about like, as you were starting your sabbatical, you're like, yeah, but there are these things going on in like the funeral and death rights world. And like, I have to step in, you know? And I think that all the time about sex work and, you know, sexual imagery and sex and culture and stuff, that I don't really do that work anymore, that advocacy anymore. I mean, I support it when I can, but you know, there are other people that are just better equipped to deal with it now than me, because I'm just not, I haven't been in that world for like 10 years. But whenever I see something come up, I'm like, fuck, I should get in there and articulate because I know how to do it and all that. And so I don't want to blame myself. I don't want to say that that's an ego thing, or that when you were feeling that was an ego thing. I think sometimes our hearts are just broken by the fact that we can't actually be the one, or that the world is, I shouldn't even say it like that. Our hearts are just broken by like how intense the problems are, and how and how much there is to change and to face down. And so I think then if I think about that, I'm like, well, a lot of the advocacy and a lot of the work I do, I really do want to do it out of a spirit of being really joyful and happy and excited. And it's not always, that too is not connected. Like I was saying to Heather, or, you know, about Heather, the Anthony Jeselnik joke about the dog or whatever, it's not just the fantasy of getting out, but like while staying in, you know, it's really important to focus on the peace in what I do, and like the actual love in what I do. I feel like it's funny, because I feel like we're saying all these things, and like in some ways, a lot of them can just be summed up by cliches that people say again and again and again on like wellness podcasts or whatever. And I'm like, so why is it so hard for me to understand that this shit is true? Like, I think part of it is because people say it as a cliche without actually, you know, like, just, you know, focus on the love and like take a break and, you know, spend time with you and make lilac tinctures. But like all that kind of stuff, I feel like I didn't really get it, you know, like, unless I look at the fact that I struggle with it, like constantly, I struggle with it. And then I'm like, whoa, those cliches are actually really hard earned. Probably not by a lot of the people that say them and just deploy them like they're nothing, but they are really hard earned.
Yeah, they are very hard earned. And to make the decision to believe yourself less important than you thought you were. And because that's really, in a lot of ways, what you're doing. And that's the hardest thing for most people to let go, is to step back away from something, whether it's an entire sabbatical, all your work, or some part of your life. To step back is to come to the unfortunate, inevitable conclusion, which is that you were not as important to whatever is going on as you thought you were. And you are not as crucial to what is going on as you thought you were. And then but to have that knowledge and to stay back and to not get involved even when you feel like you should, and to just continue to stay back, what comes up in that space is a way that you can contribute that you never even thought of before. And that was not on your radar. And so it is only in stepping back that you can see what your contribution can be. That's not just reacting to things that are happening in the world. That you're, it takes away your view of yourself as someone who's very important to everything that's going on, because you're reacting as things happen, to someone who can actually step back and make intelligent work and make an intelligent contribution that comes from a better place because of kind of a little bit of ego death that comes with stepping away and realizing that you're not like this dramatic first responder to all of society's issues.
Yeah, I think I would say that as, you know, letting go of the picture of yourself, like the importance of the picture you have of yourself, because you could be absolutely crucial and vital, but in ways that you just can't see and that you don't know. Like when I think about near-death experiences, when people die and they have all that like flood of, you know, like love and all that, I often think of that in terms of the philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein, which I do, but he was just
he's
like,
actually good. He's going to be there at your deathbed. Yeah. He's going to be like, Kano, it's time to go.
I am disappointed. No, but he, you know, he has this thing about basically, I'm just paraphrasing, but it's like, you know, everything in the world depends on everything else in the world. Like you can't take one part out. And I think that that feeling when people die and they have that, that's actually them experiencing that. All that gratitude and all that love is like, you're absolutely necessary for all the conditions, all the other conditions. So you're completely crucial, but the way in which you're crucial is something that's not really attainable or accessible to you until you see the fullness of your life. And so when you step out of like constantly needing to speak, contribute, or whatever, you can begin to see the fullness a bit more. You can get in touch a little bit more. And so you can feel a different kind of importance, a different kind of value that your life has and offers. And that's like, you know, a shift from speaking to listening, from always sort of yapping to making a bit of a negative space of yourself so you can receive. And I think that that's... That's something that when I do that in any form, even if it's just sort of sitting with someone and really listening to them and understanding that what I have to say is not going to be as important as letting them continue to speak, I can feel a real expansive sense of who I am and what I can give, you know. It's so different than speaking. Sometimes I think when I do episodes like this, where you and I have just kind of like, I remember like talking to you about this episode, I was like, we've got to have these points and it's got to be like super coherent. It's got to be this and this and this. And now we're doing it and we're kind of like winding around stuff. And I'm like, fuck, like, I actually really kind of want to do more of that, where it's just us trying to, just me and the guest or whoever, just trying to sort of listen to what comes up, instead of making some sort of declarative, totally, you know, pointed statement, because I don't live that way. If I did, I would have all my shit figured out. Like, I'd be able to demonstrate to everybody like what a perfect life would be, but that's not it. I don't have that. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't mean to like make you feel bad about the conversation by being like, with some of the other guests, we really get into like a real deep philosophical point, but you and I, we're just wandering through the fields right now. But that is actually like, I mean that in a really positive sense, you know?
You're just trying to make me feel better about how I didn't come like, brah, brah, with all the, like,
you did,
the,
like,
the just, fire. I didn't come with the fire today.
No, I'm just telling you that you're not, that we're not at work. We're actually at play and rest in this conversation.
Oh, like, I've actually been making a tincture the whole time that we've been recording this.
This episode is a sabbatical episode, actually.
Yeah, it's sort of, I mean, this is the first podcast I've done in 7 months.
Fucking crazy. That's so crazy, because you do so much media.
Yeah.
Like, when you were saying the things that you do for work, I was like, well, and also you're teaching and you're appearing on like tons of stuff and like being asked to comment on things. Like, that's all part of it too. You know, you left that out, but like, that's an afternoon sometimes, you know?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah, it is. And I told you, I had to start a little bit late because I forgot how to attach this Rode mic to the computer. I forgot how to like make this mic work, which is refreshing. That's refreshing.
Her lipstick's just smeared across her face. And yeah, she's a wreck.
I look an absolute wreck. But there's, I don't know. I guess it's tough because I think I understand what you're trying to say, in that if you can do these sort of hard won things, I can do the quite hard, strange, emotional work of taking 7 months off of something that I really care about. And I can come here and I can speak in what ultimately sort of sounds like cliches about it. And this is going to sound like a cliche, but like, when you push away the weeds and begin to make something, whether it's a book, whether it's a video, whether it's a podcast, whether it's a written offering, whatever it is, and you make a thing out of a sort of purity and love for what it is, that's a good thing. That's a positive thing. And most of us spend a lot of time not, and I think if like I had a little bit of like what I learned here, it's that everything I put out, I mean, even like thinking about like, do I want to do this podcast with Connor? Do I want to make this new video? Do I want to write a book? You know, everything has to be tested now. I don't agree to anything without it being just repeatedly stress tested as to how it aligns with my values, how it aligns with something I really genuinely want to do, how it feels in my body, how it feels as a contribution, how it feels as just like a fun thing that I would enjoy working on, how it expands me as a person. Like, everything is so, nothing is blindly said yes to anymore.
Yeah.
And the reason that I'm on this podcast is because I thought that it would genuinely, and it's turned out to be terrible, but I thought
I realized the answer was no.
I thought it was genuinely going to be a chance to like walk in the fields with you on this topic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think when I think about what you presented, first of all, that's nowhere more evident than the book that you're now working on, which I won't, reveal what it is, but like, it was so obvious when you told me. I was like, oh yeah, that's the thing, versus the book that you were mulling over for years and like really trying to like force out of your consciousness onto the page. This one just makes more sense. And I think for me, that's something I'd like to develop and work on more. And I think that that's actually the kind of sabbatical talk here, is like, if you who are listening can stand back and really think, how do I gauge true value? Like, how do I gauge the thing that I actually want to do? And we've talked about this in different ways on this podcast. One way, versus all the entanglement, the slips and tangles and the pitfalls and the PTA presidency and all that kind of stuff. But actually I can get to a place where what I want to create and offer is really from me. And maybe that's not any sort of directly creative work. Maybe that's a different kind of relationship with someone in your family, or, real meditation work, not born out of obligation to put on, my Headspace or whatever every day, or whatever it is. Rest is one of the ways to achieve that. And I think that that's so hard. It's actually one of the hardest ways to, it seems like the easiest thing, but it's one of the hardest ways to like initiate to finding that out and to getting there. And which is really weird. It takes a lot of work to get to a place of rest.
Don't go into a sabbatical with your goal being, I'm going to do this and then I'm going to be more successful and more, and I'm going to like regain my ability to be ambitious and successful when I come out of it. Like, no, your only goal should be to become more yourself.
Yeah. It's not like a hitting the reset button so you can be refreshed and like dive back into work even harder.
If you have that, I mean, I went into it being like, I may never work again. And that's not me. So like when my true self was revealed, my true self is like, actually, you really like this stuff. You like this stuff. You like this material. You like working. Go for it. Be really, really, actually, really, really, really careful.
I want to work for Lockheed Martin.
Actually making war machines.
I think that's it. I mean, I think, I've had my own versions of this many times. I wish I could live out of that place more, where I was like, I'm doing this project really because I want to. Now the book I'm working on, it is that. It started off as like, I need to make a book that will turn into like a bunch of movies. I'm not going to necessarily say what my book is either, but now I'm in it. I'm just like, I fucking love it. And it really is coming from me. It really feels genuine. It's called Jaws 17.
It's got a twisted PTA president.
But I also think like when I hired these people once to help me with my podcast, and just like get it bigger and get it. The thing they said, which was so cool, I felt defeated at the time, but now I'm just like, thank God. They were like, we can't really help you because we don't really know why your podcast is successful. You're not doing any of the things that we tell other people to do. You're doing a lot of the things that we tell people not to do. And actually, if you added some of the things we told you to do, we think that would make your podcast worse. So like, just keep doing what you're doing. It was really gratifying ultimately, because I was like, well, there's definitely a piece of this that I'm doing that is coming from me then. That is completely, and I knew that anyway, but it was a reaffirmation in a moment when actually I was trying to do the opposite. I was like, let's polish this. Let's get this out there. Let's make this completely, let's make this more accessible, bigger distribution, all that kind of stuff. And they were like, no. So
I don't think anybody who listens to you thinks that it's not coming from you. I don't think that anybody who listens to your, the weird and wonderful Connor Habib dog and pony show is like, oh, he's just trying to make a quick buck.
He's doing it for the likes. That's why he had
that. It's like, that's why he goes to this like, to the like Faroe Islands to interview like, a wise hermit collecting shells at like a on a beach and also like skips dimensional realms.
Right. What is the spiritual meaning of this cornfield? On today's episode, I'll be talking with a cultist corn farmer.
I think, no one could say you are not doing your own thing.
Yeah, but the temptation is there to not do that, you know, because, look, this is actually an unfolding conversation between us. Like, it's going to continue on and on between you and I. So I'm just happy to give people kind of a look at the way we're dealing with this particular form of work and how it's not easy. And how even stepping away from it and trying to and enjoying life away from it sometimes is also difficult. But I do think expressing this for others is, I hope for all you listening that this is helpful and hopeful and useful. Cause I know talking with you, Caitlin, is always useful and hopeful and helpful for me. So I really appreciate that about you.
Thank you. Same. And you know, this is, I feel like more than ever, this conversation about it's easy enough to have a conversation like platforms bad, content bad, algorithms bad. And that's all true. And there's a lot of like truth to power that is going on and needs to go on around that. But gosh, don't we also want to be part of people who are having the conversation about healing, right, around this and like what can be done. And I, even if some of this conversation is just us stumbling through the darkness, us and so many people are really genuinely trying to see what it is like to be a sort of ethical, self-contained person who does this kind of work. And we both think about that a lot and strive for that. And I would listen to like 14 other podcasts with other people having this same conversation. And I hope they're being made. And honestly, like if you've heard other things like this, please send us those people.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I know, because we need some help. Anyway, thank you so much, Caitlin Doty. I love talking to you. I love you. And I'm just so happy to have had you as a partner in this kind of work for so long. It's really great. Thank you.
Oh gosh. Thank you, Connor. You've been such a huge help and support and light in my life. And even though I don't always want to hear everything you have to say, because it's confronting.
Listen to it, baby.
Good for you. It's good for you. And all you listeners, listen to what he says, even if you don't want to hear it.
Especially if
take your medicine.
All right, everybody. Thank you so much for listening. Bye now.